I am Laura Coleman and I am 57. It is Friday, May the 7th, 2021, and we are recording from Baltimore, Maryland. I'm here today with Howard Collins, and Howard and I are colleagues and friends on this issue.
Yeah, my name is Howard Collins. I'm 60 years old, and yes, today is Friday, May 7th. We are recording here in Baltimore, Maryland. My recording partner with me is Laura Coleman, who is a great colleague and a good friend of mine.
So Howard, it is great to be here with you. The first time I met you was actually at a training you were presenting with Araminta Freedom Initiative. One thing that resonated with me that night was hearing the challenge to consider the ways that each one of us are contributing, either directly or indirectly, to the exploitation of our children in child sex trafficking. And quite honestly, I was defensive about that. But the more work we've done and the more time we spend studying the factors that lead to exploitation, the more convicted I became of how very true that statement is. But how did you get here? What was it that launched you into learning about this issue of child sex trafficking?
Well, believe it or not, buying a ticket to a Baltimore Orioles game with a cool t-shirt led me to attending a really pivotal conference. The stadium event was sponsored by Araminta, as was the conference. There, I found out that trafficking, child sex trafficking, was an organized evil, and it was happening a lot in the U.S. with American children and teens. Now, I was encouraged by a couple of things. One, there was a diversity of people who were involved, folks from the governor's office, teachers, church members, state police, attorneys, all types of people. Also, there was a strategy to end it. And that was very exciting to hear the community coming together to end it. And then there was a personal point for me. One of the speakers was a survivor who was trafficked in New Jersey. And that's the state in which I grew up. And that just really struck me that if someone could be trafficked in a small beach town like I grew up in, this could happen anywhere.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, Araminta is a faith-based organization, and we were started with an emphasis on that public awareness piece. Part of our mission is to awaken the community to sex trafficking through both education and prevention initiatives. And a lot of times in those trainings, we will say that this issue of trafficking happens because community has broken down in the lives of our youth, making them vulnerable.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, children and teens who don't have a safe, stable community are especially vulnerable to trafficking. They might be from broken homes and have come through the foster care system or juvenile services. And then growing up in a neighborhood possibly filled with drug addiction or gang-related violence, these kinds of things just leave our youth vulnerable to traffickers who offer a false and dangerous type of community.
Yeah, we often think of vulnerability happening because there's a lack of their basic needs being met. But we know as human beings, we were born for love and belonging. We were born for connection. And many of the things that you named are about a disconnection to a family or someone who recognizes the value and worth in a child. So when a child has experienced trauma in their young life, whether it's their own experience or they've witnessed that in the world around them, it can put them on a path to believe that pain is to be expected in relationship. I think one of the biggest contributing factors to this is the statistic around child sexual abuse in our country. Even conservative numbers indicate that 1 in 10 children growing up in the United States will experience this kind of trauma. And as a result, they don't know or believe that there is anything better out there for them.
Wow. Well, that brings us back to the name Araminta, which was chosen specifically for this mission. That was also Harriet Tubman's name as a child slave in Maryland. And part of her legacy is that she was able to cast a vision of hope for others, enslaved, those who were enslaved, and that there's something better waiting for them. But it wouldn't be easy to get there, right? they eventually trusted her enough to follow her on the Underground Railroad.
And we see that same thing happening in the lives of the survivors that we serve. It is a commitment to helping them see that their lives should not be defined by what was done to them, and that there is hope for healing and redemption on the other side of it. That's God's hope for them, and that's the hope that we have in this work.
Yeah, and that healing, it just has to happen in community, in healthy community. You know, a place where physical, emotional, and spiritual needs are met alongside others who are both caring and capable.
Yeah, we often hear people question if this really even happens in the United States. Part of the insidious nature of this criminal industry is how easily it happens all around us without even being noticed. You know, when we talk about criminal industries, the top three are drug trafficking, human trafficking, and guns and weapons. But if someone is found to have a supply of drugs or guns in their possession, that will get them unwanted attention. But when someone's found to have children with them, most of the time, no one would even ask or even know what questions to ask.
Yeah, conservative estimates are that more than 100,000 children a year are exploited in this industry in the United States. And then in Maryland, since 2013, we've had more than 670 cases reported to DSS offices. 141 cases of minors were reported in 2019. And because it's often hidden in families, massage parlors, internet invitations, these kind of under the cycle places, we don't often see how pervasive trafficking actually is.
Yeah, I have actually found that a lot of times people really aren't moved by this social injustice or social justice issues like drug addiction or homelessness until it impacts them or someone that they care about directly. Why do you care so much? You've committed a lot of time and energy to this cause. What motivates you?
Yeah, good question. I know I've spent a lot of time over the past 20 years working with guys, including myself, to become better men in our families, in our communities, in our churches. And this industry of child sex trafficking in the United States is driven primarily by men. And as good men, it's our responsibility to stand up and make a difference for our families and our communities. At least that's how I felt when I learned that we as a society are trafficking our own children and teens. So for me, it's really a privilege to be able to help.
I do understand feeling like this is privileged work. One of my favorite parts of this job is working with youth. It's the perfect blend of my two worlds, bringing my 17 years of teaching experience to help students understand sex trafficking and empower them with the knowledge they need to protect themselves and the people they care about from being a victim in this industry. And they will be the generation that can change all of this. Students often do not see themselves as victims in this crime because it is so normalized in some communities. So we often have to start with the definition of child sex trafficking.
Right. So our federal law defines child sex trafficking as the commercial exchange of anything of value, and can be food, money, drugs, cell phone, whatever, that exchange for a sex act by someone who is under the age of 18. And this is true, importantly, even if the student says they are choosing to be involved in this behavior.
Yeah, as you're saying that, this brings back a memory of a training that we did in one Baltimore City high school. When we talked about that federal definition, I had two junior girls who just shrugged their shoulders and said, "That happens every day here. You would have a hard time finding someone in this school who hasn't done that." The young girls in that high-risk community are raised to believe if there is a need they have that cannot be met, then they have to use what they do have to get that need met.
Yeah, I think the normalization is what happens in some of our neighborhoods. You know, when historically wealthy communities are in close proximity to neighborhoods of great need and hardship, it can set the stage for exploitation, especially if there's been a history of discrimination and inequity and suppression. Our U.S. history is certainly a factor, given that more than 60% of identified cases of trafficking across the U.S. are girls of color. And in addition to that, I think that a lack of awareness of what trafficking looks like or what we can even do about it keeps communities vulnerable to this industry.
Yeah, absolutely. Whether I am talking with students in these high-risk communities or in schools where the basic physical needs are being met, students are still vulnerable to this issue because of how traffickers target them on the internet. Because of the amount of time our students are currently spending online, especially since COVID, the risk of intersecting with a predator has also increased. According to one of our sources, at any given moment, there are 750,000 predators online waiting to intersect with a vulnerable child. Now, our kids today, they deserve to know how traffickers are targeting them. This year, when we launched our Teens Against Trafficking group, it's been so empowering to know that these students are able to go out and share with younger kids about the risks that, you know, that really they are being subjected to. And we're also preparing them to become culture changers on this issue.
I love that name, culture changers. And it's going to take a lot of hard work to change the culture we're in. If you think about all of the religious, political, entertainment, sports leaders who've been involved in trafficking or sexual abuse of children, so many have been involved and have received relatively few and light consequences. So that's the culture in which they live. And then there's the part where we glamorize the pimp lifestyle in our movies and in our music. This gives a false view of the destructive nature of that life.
Yeah, we actually see the other side of this issue playing out from women in media and the music industry. They utilize really highly sexualized images, dance moves, and lyrics. All of those things will catapult them to fame. But as an organization that's working to fight against the exploitation of our children, we have to consider the impact of these role models on young girls. Over the last few decades, we've witnessed the trickle-down effect as younger and younger children are acting out what they are watching their role models do on screen. So dance teams and cheer competitions, they get attention, they get applause, they get awarded by using specific costumes, makeup, and facial expressions, and performing moves that are more provocative. But in doing this, we are adultifying our young girls and grooming them to find their value in their looks and their sex appeal.
Yeah, that adultification, it's one of the contributing factors to young women of color being exploited in this industry as well. You know, one study found that compared to white girls of the same age, Black girls were viewed as in need of less nurturing, less protection, less support, less comfort, because they're seen as more independent and know more about adult topics, including sex. By adultifying a young girl, buyers try to justify that exploitation. But no little girl is born into this world to be used that way.
Yeah, there have been survivors who have said culture groomed them before they ever met their trafficker to believe that this is what women are made to do. But Howard, how did we get here? You know, 100,000 children a year are being exploited through sex trafficking. Some organizations estimate that number of children being sex trafficked worldwide would exceed 2 million. Victims of sexual exploitation are predominantly women and girls, but the fastest growing demographic being targeted, according to one international organization, is 7 to 9 year old boys. And in 2018, there were more than 45 million child sexual abuse images shared online. And then 2019, there were 69 million child sexual abuse images and videos shared online, it is impossible for me to separate this issue of child sex trafficking from child sexual abuse images, otherwise known as child pornography.
Yeah, how did we get here? Well, part of it's pretty simple. If there were no demand, there would no longer be a need for a supply. But what are we doing that's generating this kind of demand in our children or for our children? And as you said, it's hard to separate these two intricately woven industries. Not only are our children harmed in pornography, but they are harmed by pornography. Statistically, the average first exposure to pornography is around 9 years old. Many of these are accidental, but that's not always the case. So think about a moment for a young boy, 10 years old, who precociously Googles breasts, thinking he's going to see women topless sunbathing. But pornographers use a scale-free network that directs any traffic toward images that are the most profitable and the most hardcore. So this young boy sees things that are violent and graphic that he cannot process or understand and that he cannot unsee. And on some level, that makes him a little nauseous. Yet there's this part of his brain that betrays him and causes a dopamine release that he's never experienced before. And so now he's conflicted, he's ashamed, he's curious. But that curiosity usually wins out, and he returns time and time again until those images he sees become the norm. And they become part of his world, his sexual template, and it can inform the interactions that he'll seek out later in life.
Yeah, and what we know about the teen brain or the preteen brain is that it isn't fully mature yet. That prefrontal cortex, that area of our brain where we have our executive thinking skills, problem solving, our ability to recognize another human being as worth our time and attention, that's not fully developed. So anything the teen brain is exposed to before it's fully mature can impact the way the brain develops. Now, for our sex trafficking survivors, that would be the trauma of their trafficking experience that shuts down the development of the prefrontal cortex. But for a young person who is exposed to pornography consistently, it can actually impact the wiring of the brain.
Yeah, it really hijacks your rational thinking, and you begin to want what you have been watching on the screen. You know, when it comes to the brain, and males also have more receptors in their brain that make them feel like they're actually living out what is playing on the screen. I get this. I understand that. This is why, you know, we can get involved in sports and video games and even pornography. And this is also what leads many down a path of exploiting other people, you know, beyond just watching pornography. So that can happen within the context of a relationship. But we've also heard from law enforcement that there's been a higher incidence of youth-on-youth sexual assault that's being attributed to pornography use. And really, demand is more about a dissatisfaction that gives birth to a sense of entitlement and unwanted sexual behaviors.
You know, Howard, you say unwanted sexual behaviors, but that seems counterintuitive, even countercultural, right, when it comes to sexual behaviors. So can you explain that a little more?
Yeah, so, you know, in this research, we've learned that a lot of childhood experiences, you know, loneliness, abandonment, sexual abuse, other forms of neglect, you know, can put someone on a pathway to either become a buyer or to being exploited in this way. And so while those early experiences don't excuse somebody's actions, individuals who are exploited this way, they're acting out of a woundedness. Sort of in the middle of that brokenness, they either keep silent or deny that these wounds exist. And that's what leads them toward unwanted sexual behaviors, those behaviors that they would not have otherwise chosen, something that they need, they feel that they need to do given the experiences that they've had. And when adding on top of that, we live in silence and secrecy, or with the fear that someone might find out the truth, we are planting those seeds where shame grows. And so those behaviors tend to go underground, and they are secret.
Yeah, I heard someone put it this way: the pain that we do not transform, we transmit. So always someone else will have to suffer because we don't know how to. Or as our favorite shame researcher says, you know, Brené Brown, causing someone else pain is easier than dealing with my own. So are we raising a generation of people who are living in shame? How is that going to work?
Yeah, and that is one of the hard things about this generation of boys and shame. You know, a lot of the core to many of these addictive behaviors really is shame. And so just a quick sort of looking at what we mean by that, you know, shame is a deep feeling of being unworthy, defective, or worthless, usually because something I've done wrong or something that's been done to me. And shame says, I am bad. That can easily lead to all kinds of acting out behavior, because if I can't change and I'm not talking with someone else about it, I may as well just go ahead and continue in this behavior so that I can live with the pain of what it does. Also, sort of that focus on self, you know, leads us to think that everybody else knows or might find our secret, so we have to hide. And you can see how that keeps us from being in healthy relationship. And healthy relationship is a key to moving beyond our shame and our unhealthy behaviors.
Mm-hmm. That makes so much sense when you explain it that way. And you did such a good job of talking about the young boy. And so I think about, for the young girl, you know, whose value and worth is so closely tied to her physical appearance, her sexuality, shame also plays a role, but it comes from a different place. Honestly, we live in a culture that objectifies women to the point that we self-objectify, right? And we have these unrealistic standards of beauty and expectation that we cannot possibly live up to. You know, I'm not allowed to age. Don't even want to say my age, you know, right? And so our shame can be driven from that desire to measure up, right? To be enough. I don't even think this is necessarily tied directly to pornography, but it is associated with the images that are around us all the time that define beauty. And often those are highly sexualized. According to Gail Dines, the pornography researcher, girls today have one of two pathways that they can take. They need to be available or invisible. But what price are we willing to pay to make ourselves available? Or on the flip side of that, what young girl wants to be invisible? What old girl wants to be invisible, right? We have a God-given need to be seen and validated. So how does that happen when we are not even being noticed? So our shame comes from a place of not being worthy enough to even be noticed, or it can be from acting out and pushing the limits of what is acceptable in order to be noticed. So how do we fix this, Howard? Or, you know, have you ever felt like as a male that you don't really even have a voice in this issue?
For sure. And I think that ties back a little bit to thinking earlier in this conversation that as a guy, you know, we're the problem. We're the thing that causes all of this. How can we even think about being a part of it? Yet I think it's time for us to have some hard conversations, both as men and as women. Mm-hmm. Rather than hiding in our shame, we need to start sharing our stories and listening. So we've heard before that, you know, revealing leads to healing, but we can't heal that we don't reveal. And it's not easy in our current culture. And one of the things that needs to happen in our current culture is we need to have places, safe spaces for us to begin to have those conversations. We need to recognize exploitive behaviors and address those who are being exploitive. You know, we want everyone to have a confidence to speak up so that we can create that climate where that kind of behavior is seen as unacceptable.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we talk about this issue, as you said, and tend to go, well, the men, right? The role of the men in this issue. But the reality of it is women have to recognize their role in this as well. We need to be raising our children with this understanding of what exploitive behaviors are. And we need to raise our girls to find their value and worth in the gift of who they were created to be, talented, intelligent, capable, rather than focusing on their physical appearance. Now, even as grown women, we can struggle with this one, right? I had this happen in my own world. I have a good friend who is a successful professional, accomplished and intelligent. And part of her work is to be in front of high school students sharing about career options. And one evening I was at her home after she had presented at an all-boys school earlier in the day. Now, her husband was on the phone with a good friend of his, and his friend mentioned that his 15-year-old son had watched her session that day. And of course, she asked, well, what did he think? And her husband talks for a few more seconds to his friend, and then there's this awkward kind of pause, and he kind of laughed. And then he looked at us and he said, he and his friends think you're a MILF. Now, I was appalled. And I looked at her thinking, oh, we're offended, right? But she smiled and she looked back and she said, really? As though it was a compliment. And so I looked back and forth at her husband, like, we're not okay with this, right? And I looked at her, like, we're not okay with this, right? But in the end, I didn't say anything. And her husband didn't say anything. And the father of the 15-year-old boy didn't say anything. And our silence gave consent for this young man and his friends to treat this woman like an object that he wanted to use for his own gratification. That's exploitation. Now, it took many months during our research of this work before I was finally convicted that I had to go back and talk to them about what had happened in that, you know, experience. And they graciously encouraged me to share this story with others because they recognize too, they're raising a little girl. They want better for her than for her to be raised in that environment. And we need more people who will break that silence. We were created with good intentions for love and belonging and being respected and cherished, but instead we've accepted a counterfeit in place of the real thing.
Yeah. I love that story because it's so normal and it's a regular conversation that you could see happening every day. So we're all a part of this. You know, we mentioned at the start of this that trafficking of our youth happens because community has failed them. If we're going to shift this dynamic and change our culture, be culture changers, we need to start healing in healthy communities. And this means having those honest conversations. The more honest we are about ourselves and our own stories, the further it will move us forward in both personal and community healing. You know, we need accountability partners to share stories of the transformative and healing power of friendships. I mean, the truth is, every story is redeemable. And I want to emphasize that. I know in my life and the life of my friends and others, there is no story that's not redeemable. And just like those who were enslaved that needed to hear from Araminta that a better life was possible, that's true on this side of the story as well. God wants better for those who are enslaved by unwanted sexual behaviors, and he can use everything, the exploitation, the betrayal, the broken families, the lack of purpose, all the shameful stories to bring personal and community healing. Because in community, we have an opportunity to be transformed by love.
Howard, we took a two-year journey together with that demand response team that led us to this point. I am extremely grateful for that time together. You know, other demand response programs that we found across the country were all punitive in approach. But what we learned to be true is that this is a problem of the heart, and punitive approaches rarely change hearts. I learned so much during that time that helped me to see buyers differently. Quite honestly, I was of the thinking early on, if we just arrest them all, this problem will go away, right? But then I realized that this is not all the evil men. It is so pervasive in the world around us. And one story in particular stands out to me because we received this letter from a man about a year after he was motivated to reveal his own hypocrisy, his own hidden truths about the way he had been living in the previous 30 years. And he wrote, "Thank you for not being judgmental or unforgiving. Rather, you have been grace-filled and kind. Your response convicted me not to run and hide. And if not for you, I would have gone on to live in shame and apart from God." You know, isn't that where our hope really lies on this issue? That we all stop running, that we stop hiding, and then we can begin to flourish as human beings in relationship as God always intended. I want to thank you, Howard, for your honesty, for your integrity, for your work on this, and for taking this journey with me.
And thanks, Laura. Me as well. And I remember going through our time together, being amazed that men and women could have these hard conversations together and actually come out to a place where we could appreciate one another and we could make a difference in this industry. Thank you as well.